Matt Delcombe is our guest today. Matt serves as director of the Center for Business and Information Technologies at UL Lafayette. He is also innovation managing director for the National Science Foundation-sponsored Center for Visual and Decision Informatics. With over 30 years of leadership experience in the IT sector, Matt spent 30 years at Oracle Corporation and Sun Microsystems before joining UL. A graduate of UL Lafayette with a BS and MS in computer science, Matt is a boomerang, and I'm excited today to be able to talk about his community involvement and, really importantly, what's going on at the university. And I know you enjoy what you do. I think I read you're enamored by technology trends and using IT to solve complex business challenges. So Matt Delcombe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited about our conversation.
We kind of were introduced through our mutual friend, Chris Rader, who's also from New Iberia. So I want to thank Chris for everything that Rader Solutions does and for making this connection for us. So you want to start talking first about your background growing up in New Iberia and how you got into the computer world?
Yes. So I'm actually a Lafayette native. I was actually born right down the road from here, St. Landry at Lord's Hospital. But I did grow up in New Iberia,
I
play both sides of that to my advantage. Grew up in New Iberia, attended Catholic High. And my father worked for the university for several years. In fact, retired from the university as head of the business system, a business administrator here, and was always interested in technology. My father was a World War II veteran, fought in the Pacific, and had a technology role in what he did in the Navy, and that kind of followed him throughout his career. And so he was a partner with Dr. James Oliver and some of the leadership back then about bringing in computer science and computers into the university. And so my brother was a graduate of computer science here, and I kind of followed in those footsteps.
Mm-hmm. I want to make a point before we move on. In 1962, USL actually offered the first Master of Science degree in computer science. So USL and now UL Lafayette has always been far thinking and I think leading the way for this industry. And I don't know that a lot of people understand that.
You know, we're so fortunate that, you know, the leadership at the university back then saw the advantages, saw where the things were going in making that investment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite a feather in our hat. You know, we grew out of the mathematics department. But in the early 60s, to have a master's of computer science you know, really put a focus on the university.
Yeah. I've heard that it was really USL and MIT that were the leaders in the country.
Yeah. Several universities. And no doubt, I think we followed a lot of the MIT direction and in the investments we made, not just from the programmatic side, but also at the time of the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Bringing in the MULTIC system back then was a big deal for the university, a major investment, a major commitment, and that kind of followed what some of the larger computer science schools were doing at the time.
Right. Once you graduated, did you work in state, or was that immediately when you joined some of these companies I mentioned?
So I finished my master's program and kind of just stayed at the university. I didn't know what else to do and enrolled in the PhD program and was a laboratory research manager. So I taught some computer science classes and worked within the university. We did a project that involved some infrastructure and networking systems with Sun Microsystems. So about 6 months working on that grant and working with them, they offered me a role at Sun, and this was in 1987.
Oh.
And I made the jump to Sun Microsystems back then.
Uh-huh. And then you also worked with Oracle. What did they do? What does Oracle Corporation do?
So Oracle is one of the leading manufacturers, producers of business software for Industry 500 companies. So their database, their ERP or management software is what runs most of the Fortune 500 companies.
Mm-hmm.
So finance, insurance, manufacturing, all of the major industries usually run on Oracle software. It's a very large company, one of the largest software and infrastructure companies in the United States or in the world.
So what brought you back to Louisiana? And in particular, back to your alma mater.
Both my wife and I are from South Louisiana. Our families are both from here. you know, we both grew up with very large families, very close families, and we wanted our kids to better experience that. Unfortunately, my dad was diagnosed with cancer and passed away a short time after, and we were living out of state, and at that point, my wife and I sat down and decided, you know, we want our kids to grow up with their grandparents. We want our kids to know their cousins, their aunts and uncles. And we made the decision to come back. I was fortunate at Sun Microsystems where I was covering the United States, and I had a role where not only when I inquired about relocating, I was encouraged. So in the early 2000, they said, move wherever you want, we don't care. You know, you're getting on a plane anyway. And in fact, it was kind of interesting because not only did they encourage me, you know, they said, look, we'll pay for your phone, we'll pay for your office, we'll give you a check to buy your furniture, we'll pay your phone bills. So they really encouraged it and kind of used that work from home as an incentive to work for Sun Microsystems.
And you ended up at the university, though, if you want to talk about that. I know you were somewhat recruited.
Yeah, so I was able to work from home, working out of Acadiana for a good 10, 15 years while at Sun and while at Oracle, but on the road every week. So getting up on Mondays and getting in an airplane to New York or Chicago or Denver or San Francisco. And, you know, I told my wife at 55 that it was time to slow down. And Dr. Kudaru Ramesh, who's Vice President of Research and Economic Development, had been trying to recruit me back to the university for a long time. And I think it was at the CGI opening, or maybe the Proficient opening, he basically said, Matt, it's time. And I said, let's do it.
That's great.
And I've been here ever since.
Yeah, so you're here like, we're really growing in our tech businesses here. I mean, we're right across the street from CGI, and I know you're close with Will Labar, and he's been a guest on the show, Matt. There's so much going on here in Lafayette. I'd like you to jump in, if you can start talking about what is going on at UL. In particular, you know, I mentioned earlier about research. I know there's a lot of research going on, and you're also this innovation managing director for the, it's a mouthful, for the Center of Visual and Decision Informatics, but that's funded through the National Science Foundation. There's just so much going on. I don't know anything about all this, so why don't you let us know what you're doing?
Thanks, Jane. Those are some great questions. You know, we're very fortunate. We really have a hidden gem in the university, particularly on the research side. You know, the growth in the research dollars over the past 10 years have been phenomenal. Last year, I think we closed out with about $125 million in R&D expenditures, which, you know, puts us in the top 25% of the 650 research institutions in the U.S., and that's quite a feather in our cap. You know, it is growing dramatically. UL established a goal several years ago to become Carnegie R1, I think it's now called, the universities with the highest research level, and we're just on the cusp of that. And I think in the next round of reviews, which happen in another year or so, we're pretty confident that we'll be in that tier. And when you look at the $125 million of funding that we receive, you know, that puts us above universities such as Ole Miss and University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. It puts us in great company. And in fact, if you look at the cumulative research dollars of all the other universities in the UL system, you know, Louisiana Tech and University of New Orleans and, you know, Southeastern and Northwestern's up in Natchitoches and so on. If you do their cumulative totals and double it, it's still less than what we do here.
It's amazing.
And there's a tremendous impact in the community. You know, UL has, you know, somewhere around a $500 million impact in our community. And when you take the research side of it, right, when there's research dollars spent, that means we're supporting additional graduate students, we're supporting additional faculty members, we're partnering with industry, we're buying products, we're employing more people, right? So we have, you know, 20,000 students and 2,000 staff and faculty members. It's quite an economic impact.
Right.
I think we're the third largest employer in Lafayette, if I'm not mistaken.
And you had also said that a lot of those research dollars come from industry. They're not just from government, but these are from private concerns that are supporting this research.
Yeah, the tagline the university uses is called Research for a Reason. And a lot of it is applied research. And one of the things we pride ourselves on is that the majority of our, a large part of our funds actually comes from industry. And I think we're probably in the top 10 in the U.S. in the percentage of funds from industry. You know, historically, universities are funded through government entities such as, you know, NIH, National Institute for Health, the National Science Foundation, or the Department of Defense. And while we pursue funding through all of those agencies, we go the extra mile and really focus on getting funding from industry because we feel that that's our best way of giving back. We feel that engages our students more and better prepares them for the industry.
Right. Now, you've told me that it's all about data analytics and how to derive the data for the best use, you know, to solve problems. So can you give an example or two of what you guys actually do? Like, what do you research?
Yeah. So I, as part of the university, I'm inside of what they call the Informatics Research Institute, and it's a grouping of about five different centers. And while they may have different focuses on health innovation or cybersecurity or public safety or smart connected communities, the common theme across all of those is really around data. Data analytics is about gaining information out of the data. It's about getting insights from the data. And that's really our focus. And, you know, over the past several years, you've heard a lot of you know, sayings, right? Data is the new oil. It's what should be mined. It's what should be refined. And that's really our approach. And the Center for Visual and Decision Informatics is a consortium of six universities founded by UL, includes Drexel University in Philadelphia, Stony Brook out on Long Island, University of Virginia in Charlottesville, UNC Charlotte in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as Tampere University in Finland. And these universities have come together along with industry partners to do research and data analytics to help move the industry forward.
And you're the director, the managing director.
So the executive director of the center is Dr. Vijay Raghavan. He's the founder of the center, and he's a researcher and a professor in the School of Computing here at UL. My role as managing director is to run the day-to-day operations, particularly in making sure that the 20-something, I think we have 26 industry partners that provide us funding, that we're delivering on the projects, we're meeting the milestones, and that the university researchers understand what are the key components, the key metrics that these industry providers really
right.
want.
Out of this, I've got some notes about, I know there was just a grant, and you're serving as technical lead for the City of Lafayette's participation in the Smart Gigabit Cities Initiative. Is that some of the things that come out of this, or is that a separate hat
it's
that you wear?
It's kind of separate. So,
and what is that, too?
One thing that's been fun at the university is that I do have the opportunity to wear a few different hats, and I think most people at the university do the same thing. We do whatever we can to promote research, to promote industry, and to promote connectivity within our community. And several years ago, US Ignite, which was an NSF, another National Science Foundation sponsored initiative that came out of the White House, was around communities that have gigabit infrastructure. What can they do different?
Okay.
Right? So.
And that's us.
And Lafayette was one of them. We were one of the initial eight cities that were selected. And I think it's grown to 25 cities. And really, what US Ignite has done is connected these cities and allow us to share experiences, allowed us to share expertise, share connectivities on what works and what doesn't, with the goal of providing, you know, better citizen engagement, better citizen services. One of the areas that we focus on in here in Lafayette is around public safety, particularly around resilience and recovery. You know, we had a lot of catastrophic events when you're looking back from hurricanes to floods and things like that.
And then can't communicate.
Right. So that's been kind of our focus in Lafayette as part of U.S. Ignite. And so we partnered with Lafayette Consolidated Government. You know, then Mayor President Robideau was in full support. And what we one of the projects that we did is help him align of where do we move forward on smart city concepts within Lafayette Consolidated Government? You know, better transparency to the data. How do citizens get better information and get information in real time? You know, how do we kind of set the direction on where we're going in on the fiber side, things like that. So 5G, for example, and what does it mean to the city, and how are other cities coping with this? You know, what does an innovation district look like, and why an innovation corridor is important, and you know, how does that bring in startups?
What is an innovation district?
So a lot of the cities that we work with made a decision to try to promote their tech industry through saying, if we had a district that was moving forward, mm-hmm. that could kind of showcase what a city of the future may look like, where at the time it may just be simple as we're going to do public Wi-Fi and we're going to do some uh-huh. 5G testing and we're going to have smart parking and our street lights will be LED. And
the traffic lights might be synchronized.
And like synchronized or, you know, things like
please.
That. And
and
so what we did is we visited a lot of those cities to understand what approaches work, what didn't. To also provide a hub for the entrepreneurial spirit, right? If you have startups. And in a way, Opportunity Machine downstairs mm-hmm. here has kind of has filled that gap, and we've relied on them for our innovation center as part of it. So LEAD has been part of a lot of these conversations, Lafayette Consolidated Government, mm-hmm. as well as Opportunity Machine on you know, what makes sense. And I think then Mayor Robideau's view is, you know, I don't want just a downtown innovation district. I want the city of Lafayette to be an innovation mm-hmm. district. We have fiber everywhere.
Right.
We have connectivity everywhere. Let's not limit ourselves to a small geographical footprint. Let's do what we can to make all of Lafayette an innovative innovation
right.
hotbed.
We had on Monique Belay a few months back mm-hmm. with the Acadiana Planning Commission, and she was talking about this, you know, there's research and people don't even know who's got working internet outside of this area. There are pockets right near us, and there's not really a map about who's got what. And we are so blessed here to have fiber, much less, you know, internet, like dependable internet.
No, it is quite refreshing to attend, you know, US Ignite conferences and smart city conferences, and we're a poster child. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. We are referenced. I remember a year and a half ago in Kansas City, they had a conference, and each of the cities were kind of talking about their approach, and our mayor went up there and talked about his approach and what we were doing and the connectivity that we mm-hmm. have. And the mayor of San Francisco got up right behind him and said, I want to be like Lafayette.
Oh, man.
Right? So to have the mayor in the middle of Silicon Valley say, I want your
wow.
type of connectivity is quite the compliment.
Very much. And I wish we had, you know, Fisherman's Wharf or something,
right.
but I'll take what we have. This yeah. is a great community. So some of the other work that you're doing at the university, I kind of cut you off when I asked about the smart cities. Why don't you talk about some of the work that you're doing and these other, you know, with the other hats you're wearing?
So we talked a little bit about the Center for Visual and Decision mm-hmm. Informatics and about the data analytics research we do with a lot of industry partners. And we have some great partners here in Lafayette, like CGI and Schumacher Clinical Partners, USGS has been a member. So we're very fortunate we have a lot of local support, as well as large companies mm-hmm. across the U.S. being part of it. And, you know, some of the roles, particularly around what we try to do around connected communities, and we talked a little bit about specifically around Lafayette, you know, while we've been fortunate that we have connectivity everywhere, we still have challenges within our students around, are they, now that they have access, are they getting the educational foundation that they need? So what can we do to promote more STEM, particularly around our disadvantaged communities? So we've been able to do a lot of work partnering with companies like CGI mm-hmm. and Cajun Code Fest and Crescent Lab Challenge. I put in a grant from Mozilla, I guess it's now about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, where we received $175,000, where we did several projects to kind of bridge that digital divide, to try to open the door to a lot of the disadvantaged youth about how technology can impact them. And that's so rewarding. We have a long ways to go, but I think we're making significant progress.
Did you go in the schools for that? How do you partner with the schools?
We partner with the schools. We partner through some of the community groups, mm-hmm. You know, that represent those schools. We were fortunate that we had a lady within the Lafayette Parish School System that was just a phenomenal advocate for us mm-hmm. and you know, gave us the direction on the wood schools
yeah.
And how we should approach it. We were fortunate that Mozilla actually hired a lady, Ms. Leah Ruffin, to come in here and mm-hmm. actually run it for those 18 months.
Oh my
goodness.
So
she did a phenomenal job. of driving that within our community.
So I know about the Karen Crow High Information Technology Academy, but this goes younger than that. You're talking about, or was it just high school students? Were you trying to reach out to middle school?
We targeted middle school and high school, and even some of our projects and initiatives, such as Cajun Code Fest, that were initially focused on professional and then high school. We've even branched down into middle school. And, you know, it's for a lot of different reasons. One is, you know, we have a need here in Lafayette for technical professionals.
Right.
We actually have a, you know, a demand for for STEM graduates. And what we want to do is start to build that pipeline into our university and into our community colleges, you know, into our trade schools, you know, for those curriculums.
Yeah, it's kind of a circle. You need to have the talent for the companies to want to come. You know, and you need to have the degrees available so that people can learn what they need to. So, do you still teach? Do you teach any classes?
I don't. I'll guest lecture every now and then. I think they try to keep me out of the classroom.
Oh, yeah? Reasons? No.
I do enjoy. I have some areas that I really like to talk about, particularly around cloud computing, around continuous integration and agile development, kind of the, you know, what I saw in the industry in my experience at Sun Microsystems and at Oracle, and the way the industry was going. And, you know, one of the challenges within a structured computer science department is that while they do their best to stay abreast of the technologies, because there are accreditations they have to go through, there's a core curriculum that they have to adhere to through ACM and through others.
Oh, I see. And so things change so quickly.
Things change quickly so that they do their best to stay accredited, but at the same time to try to introduce the newer technologies and the newer approaches into the curriculum. So they try to be as flexible. There's about 800 students in our School of Computing Informatics. I think they're close to graduating about a little bit less than 100 a year. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty phenomenal. They have two different degree programs, the computer science program, which is very structured, and the informatics program, which allows a lot more flexibility in their approach.
I remember Will Labar talked about that. You learn about business and practical things that people go through, right? And not just how to code or
exactly
hardware needs, but the holistic approach to solving the problems.
And some of the informatics is focused around data analytics. Some of it is focused around specific verticals. In other words, there's an informatics that's focused on the health information, for example, which is a tremendous need in our community, a tremendous growth area. Some of them are a little bit more focused on the administrative side, right? So I want to be a cloud architect or a systems architect or systems administration. So it's that side of it. So a lot of flexibility, and they're able to stay abreast of some of the newer approaches.
We did a show recently here at Raider, and it was on cybersecurity, and they had their team talking about the real threats that they, you know, I didn't even have a passcode on my phone. And so before we left that day, I now have to have my face, you know, do the face recognition stuff. But a lot of us just don't realize how vulnerable we are. In your school, is this part of the curriculum, or is this like, it seems like it's all in the news all of a sudden, but probably this has been ongoing.
So no
quite
doubt,
a while.
You know, cybersecurity is at the forefront. You know, and if we look locally within our state and our communities, there's been a lot of breaches, a lot of hits. You know, within the School of Computing Informatics, while there are cybersecurity classes and focus area, one of the things they pride themselves on is that throughout the computer science core curriculum, cybersecurity is built in. So when you're taking a computer architecture course, study of machine architectures, you're learning about cybersecurity. When you're taking a compiler course, you're learning about cybersecurity. You know, when you're looking at data structures and how to represent data, you're talking about cybersecurity. So you know, they feel that it's built into every course, not just a one-off, take this course and you know what's going on.
Yeah, just one course that could change.
And, you know, there's a lot of other things besides cybersecurity that goes into it, right? So when, you know, people think of computer science as computer science curriculum, but when you start layering things in, like not just cybersecurity, but the whole personalization, the whole privacy piece of computer science is a big component. And then that layers in the ethical side, right? How ethics come into it, right? So all of that plays a role in computer science.
That's really interesting. I didn't think about that. I know as lawyers and doctors, the privacy concerns are very real. But the ethical, that's interesting.
Yeah, so privacy and ethics are a big component in computer science.
Yeah, keeping the data you know, where it's trusted, you know, that your data is private. That's interesting. Do the kids, what are you seeing? Like, do you have to be a math geek, you know, people that are coming through, or do you see all kinds of students? Not geek, I shouldn't have said that, but, you know, I never was good in math.
It's okay, we'll take geek.
It's meant as a compliment.
Look, no doubt our phone in the gaming world has changed people's approach to computer science and has upped people's interest. So I think you're seeing a wide swath of interest, right? So you have your traditionalists that are really technical geeks and math geeks.
Pencils in their shirt pocket.
Right, and they're really looking at the computer science theory side of things. But you have a lot who are looking at the applied sciences side, right? And whether it's a gaming curriculum, again, whether it's something on a cybersecurity focus that they're interested in, whether it's development, they want to be a coder. And the flexibility of the program, particularly with informatics, kind of addresses all of those.
Yeah, what a great field to be in as a student and as a professor. So let me ask you, I know there's some other things you're very interested probably in sharing. You're not just busy with the university, but you're very committed to the Evangeline area Boy Scouts. And you said your boys were Eagle Scouts, and
I was an Eagle Scout. I thoroughly enjoyed my time in Scouts, and the leadership skills that were provided to me, the opportunity for leadership skills at a young age, I think helped mold me and helped my career. And I saw the same thing in my sons, and all of them were Eagle Scouts. And it's very rewarding to see the kids grow up and mature from 11 years old to 18 years old and give them the opportunity, not just in the outdoors, not just being able to visit exciting places around the U.S., but also to interact with scouts from around the world, scouts from other states, to do citizens projects, to give back and teach those leadership skills. So I'm fortunate that the Evangeline Area Council allowed me to be on their board. So that's something that I'm committed to and enjoy. I'm fortunate also that the scouts in this area are very active, and I know we have a lot of mutual friends.
Yeah, Gary McGoffin. I called him yesterday, and I know he's a big scouting.
He's just a great guy, great mentor. We're very, very lucky to have him in our community.
Yes.
You know, scouts made a commitment some 10 years ago on their 100th anniversary. Our local Evangeline Area Council made a commitment to preserve in the Chafalaya Basin. Mm-hmm. And they went out and wanted to plant 1,000 trees, and I think that multiplied by a whole lot, and do trash pickup. And one of the challenges that were given was, how do we make this last forever, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing to do a service project. And one of the things is we have this great overflow swamp, the nation's largest overflow swamp here locally, within minutes of our citizens here, and we really have no gateway to it. There's no way to say, how can I enjoy the basin easily without having my own boat or my own car, my own canoe or kayak to go in, and where do I put in? And so what the scouts want to do is provide a gateway into this overflow swamp, not just from scouts from around the country or around the world, but also for citizens, and to really have it as an educational facility. And Swamp Base was formed, and so now we're operating out of the old McGee's Landing, and we have treks.
Where is that, Henderson?
That's right, in Henderson. And we have about 1,000 scouts that come through a summer, all from out of state.
Oh, they do?
That come and spend a week in our Chafalaya Swamp.
Oh, my goodness.
Paddling the swamp from the beginning to the end, setting out hoop nets and catching catfish and living off the land and sleeping in hammocks and sleeping in houseboats and doing airboat tours and airboat rides and basically living in the basin for a week. And the reviews are just phenomenal.
That's a great, what a great thing to set up for others to share this natural beauty. I bet they're blown away when they see it.
It's just phenomenal.
It's gorgeous.
To see them come out of the Chafalaya after a week, it's they really feel like they've conquered everything.
Yeah, what a great experience. I saw that on your resume, and I also saw the Coastal Conservation Association, as well as the TETCH project. So you really are very concerned about our environment and protecting our natural resources.
Yeah, we're very fortunate with just a multitude of organizations that are focused on conservation. And you know, they go from everything from, you know, the hunting side with DU and Delta Waterfowl, mm-hmm. which really, you know, really focus on wetlands preservation. And CCA is something that's close. And I know you've had people on here that mm-hmm. have it very close to them. I love to saltwater fish, and I love to protect our resources. The TESH project is something that started up on the Bayou TESH. I'm fortunate that I live on the bayou, so I see it every day, every afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I grew up on the Bayou TESH as a kid, learning to water ski on it and fish on it. And it's really about making it a waterway that all of us can enjoy, mm-hmm. and to promoting the right. economies of what it means to have a clean and accessible waterway.
Mm-hmm. We're lucky that you moved back. It's fun to listen to what you can do. I know you were saying that one of the reasons you were glad to be back was that you could be engaged in the community, and you certainly have been. Is there anything, I have one more question for you, but is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to get in, Matt, about UL or anything?
You know, the only thing about UL, again, I'm so appreciative of them giving the opportunity to be a part of that community. Mm-hmm. It's really a great university, and, you know, we have tremendous community support. Lafayette was, you know, so fortunate that the leadership, you know, back at the turn of the century,
mm-hmm. 1900, yeah, when it opened, yeah.
Made the push to get the university mm-hmm. here, because it wasn't necessarily targeted to be here initially.
Oh, and that's what built, that was the initial right. thing that built this community.
Right, and no doubt, I think Lafayette is who Lafayette is, mm-hmm. the hub city, because of the university.
Mm-hmm. That and utilities, it's an internet now. So.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, there's one other thing I want to get in before. I know Jason Sikora here with Raider has some questions for you. So you made the news, was it last year? And you were known as the fellow that saved the Magna Carta. You were on vacation in the UK, and you intercepted a fellow that was attempting to steal one of the four copies of the Magna Carta, right, the oldest known version. Would you, I know you're just nodding your head, would you please share what it was like to be known for being a superhero?
So I don't think that's the right term. I think I would have done what most people would have done. So I don't consider myself a hero. And, you know, we were in London, my wife and I. I was invited to give a presentation at Ravensburg College. And, you know, we've been fortunate to be able to tour a lot of Europe, but mm-hmm. had never really toured the countryside. So we went a few days early and went through the Cotswolds and were touring the countryside and had visited. I think we'd spent the night in Bath and had taken a day trip down to Stonehenge. My wife was really interested to see Stonehenge. And we were going to spend the evening in Salisbury, which has a very famous cathedral. It's the tallest steeple in England. It was built in the 1200s. Just a beautiful, beautiful facility. And inside of that cathedral is also one of the original four copies of the Magna Carta. And we got there kind of late in the evening. It was kind of interesting. So we came in. It was right around closing time. So maybe they closed at 5 and we got there at 4:30 or something. And when we walked in, they said, look, go to the chapter house and see the Magna Carta first, because they're going to close it at 5. There's evening song in the cathedral, so you can stay in the cathedral as late as you want. So we walked down the cloister to the chapter house, and in older cathedrals, the chapter house is where all of the clergy and the monks would periodically meet. Very beautiful room. Again, this was built in the 1200s. A circular room with chairs up on a ledge that kind of surround it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the at that time, the bishop would then could address the clergy. And the Magna Carta was in a little tent room in the middle of this chapter house. So we visited, we talked with people in the museum and had that conversation.
And the Magna Carta is, if you can explain, just kind of... For those wondering, they don't have to go back and look it up.
So the Magna Carta, in essence, was a charter of rights. I think Magna Carta actually means the Great Charter, you know, if, mm-hmm. the interpretation. It was issued in the early 1200s with a way to try to solve a feud between the barons and the king.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically gave some civil rights, basically the right to a fair trial, the right of to individual landowners.
It's an early constitution.
Constitution. It's really been the basis for basically almost every civil rights document since. Our constitution was based on, in part, on some of the articles or some of the items in the Magna Carta.
And issued by the Pope at that time.
So it was written by the Archbishop of Canterbury, if I'm not mistaken, and then distributed to all the diocese. And that's how this diocese of Salisbury, I think it was Sarum back then, received a copy of it.
So this was a very valuable document.
Yes, and they were telling us it's the best preserved copy of all of them, and it's the only one that had been in the same location throughout. It was rediscovered in, I think, the 1800s. It had been lost in the archives of the church and found. I know we got a little sidetracked there.
Yeah, but I want people to understand this is, it's a big document.
No, it is, and you know, there is a version of the Magna Carta actually in our National Archives. It was one that was issued a little bit later. What ended up happening is that it was revoked and reissued several times depending on the feuds or the wars, which pope came in and
what
stuff.
What rules were the best.
Exactly. So over the course of several hundred years, it had been reissued several times. So there's a whole bunch of different versions of Magna Carta. So we were fortunate. We were able to view the Magna Carta, and we were walking into evening song and inside of just a beautiful cathedral. And I had stopped to run to the restroom real quick, and I was drying my hands because I remember the dryer was on and the fire alarm goes off. I'm like, and I was pretty disappointed. I'm thinking,
darn,
I'm not going to see the cathedral.
I know.
So I walk out and my wife was waiting outside, and she says, something's not right. A man came out of the handicapped bathroom. I think he pulled the fire alarm. He went into the chapter house. And, you know, women just have this sixth sense. They're so much more aware than men are, you know. Women are so much more sophisticated than men. I'll just leave it at that. We're simple people. They're not. And, you know, she knew something wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, everybody's, leaving the chapter house, leaving the cathedral because the fire alarm's going off. And, you know, she alerted the guards and the staff saying, this is not right. There's somebody in there that shouldn't be in there. So she's the real hero of this whole thing. And sure enough, the man had gone in there with a hammer and was bashing on the case to try to take the Magna Carta. The staff went in and he ran out. By that time, I was coming down the corridor and gave chase. And
you did.
You know, I tried to stop him. He got to the outside door. We were running down the cloister to an outside door, and, you know, he raised the hammer like he was going to hit me and gave an explicative, and so I let him out, and at that point I said, he's going to get away. So I followed him outside. They had a courtyard, the stone yard, and ran after him yelling. And
stop that man.
Stop that man. I'm sure everybody's looking, what is this American tourist doing? And
then a man with a hammer.
And we were able to stop him right when he got outside the gate and into the opening. So very fortunate that he didn't get away.
And he was just prosecuted just recently, right?
Yeah, this came came back to light last week. We actually had the trial. I was able to...
You were a witness.
I was a witness, interviewed by the prosecution and cross-examined by the defense. We did it via video link. So it was very interesting, very formal.
Don't they wear the wigs?
Yeah, the judge and the prosecutor and the defense
barristers.
All had the wigs.
Yeah.
Barristers. It was kind of interesting because, the judge was an elderly gentleman and the prosecutor was an elderly... the defense attorney was very, very young, but he had his
wig?
He had his wig on.
Are they long wigs or kind of like to the shoulders?
So the... The defense had a shorter wig, but it was a little bit longer in the back. The judge had a longer one.
He did.
Yeah, so it was interesting.
That's pretty cool.
But very formal, very, very, I don't know if polite is the right word.
It is, yeah.
You know.
Very civil.
Very, very civil. I mean, even during the cross-examination, it was extremely...
It's like watching Parliament, though.
Yeah.
You know, you're just not going to see the yelling and screaming. I guess you might see raised voices, but not being rude.
You know, one thing that was interesting, you know, after all this happened, the suspect was gathered and the police came, and my wife and I were leaving. We said, well,
Did you get to see the singing or in here?
So we were going to leave, and I'm thinking, we got to see the cathedral. So we're going to wait. We're going to wait and see what happens now that we know there's not a fire. And sure enough, we were able. So we went in and for evening song. And so we're sitting in the cathedral. And next thing you know, they're kind of a tap on the shoulder saying, you know, come with us. Mm-hmm. And
darn.
Yeah. And the head clergy was Reverend Papadopoulos. I remember his name, Nick Papadopoulos, pulled us to the side and said, you need to be interviewed. So the police were there, and it was so British. We sat down in a stone room, and it was stone arches, and they were interviewing us, giving our statements, and we're drinking tea. They bring us a pot of tea, a cup of tea, and so we're having tea, giving our statements in this room that was probably built in 1200-1300. It was pretty.
Not your typical tourist event.
Right.
But they needed you to place him at the scene of what happened. So that's great. Well, thank you for your service. And what an experience.
It was quite the experience. Not what I expected. I mean, I guess the main thing I learned about this is you have no privacy. Because what happened after that, I think, is the most interesting. All right. You know, Scott McNeely, our CEO at Sun Microsystems, used to always say, you have no privacy, get over it. It's done. Mm-hmm. And the next morning, my phone started ringing, and texts started happening, and people started calling.
Your name got out.
The name, number got out, and especially the British tabloids. It was pretty phenomenal how they track you down.
Wow.
I mean, it was almost scary. When I got to the hotel, they had people waiting for me to interview me.
Yeah. Well, what you did was brave. I know you're making light of what you did, but that was very brave and pretty incredible.
Yeah.
You know, just happened chance.
I never felt threatened. I didn't think I was, being brave. I didn't want him to escape. I didn't want it to be me. I'm a tourist. Mm-hmm. I needed staff or their security to do it. But the reality is that it was my wife that was the one.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, she was a hero. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I know you were reluctant, but I wanted to get your version of what happened in, because people may have read about that. So, Matt, we're here with Jason Sikora of Raider, and you probably have some questions.
This is
your field.
I do, and nothing's going to beat that story, though. That was so good. Thank you for that, and thank you for being here, Matt. First of all, shout out to the Scouts. We love the Scouts. Even here at Raider Solutions, we have a Scout leader, and I'm good friends with Art, the executive director.
Yeah,
and they do great work.
And Chris is a very strong supporter.
Yes.
You can't thank him enough for what he does. And, look, it's all about molding young women, young men, mm-hmm. and preparing them for the future.
Yeah, that Swamp Base, I've talked about going on it a few times as a leader, just to tag along, because it sounds so much fun. So let's go back to the beginning of the interview. Just a term that you guys used a few times before and during that is above my head. What's a boomerang?
So I think a boomerang usually refers to somebody who has left.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So
gotcha.
I'm from Acadiana.
And then you left and came back.
Yeah.
I left for 15, 20 years in the high-tech industry, but then I came back to
thank you for
Atlanta.
Asking
okay.
that. I've heard that term so much, but
it was totally over my head. And if it's over my head, that means it's over a few
it's
other
over
people's.
A lot of, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, that makes sense.
We're probably dating ourselves, Jen.
I think so, yeah. Doesn't take much for me to do that.
There's probably a newer term that's used for that.
Possibly, but that's the best term, though. I can't throw a boomerang, so have you ever tried?
Not very successful.
Yeah, no, they don't. They never come back. They just keep on going. So what's the hardest part of data mining and analytics? Is it data points? Is it correlation? Is it security? Is it kind of all those things together?
Every problem's different, right? Of course, there's the whole garbage in, garbage out. So, one of the items that's very important in the whole data mining is the whole data cleansing, understanding that you actually have good data, right?
And, that makes sense.
So that's one of the things that we focus on, right? Is making sure that if we're going to start drawing conclusions from this data, and this applies to almost everything, right? Whether it's strict data analytics, but even when you start going into machine learning and AI, your whole teaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your whole sets have to be valid, because if not,
things can go wrong. Yeah,
things can go wrong.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. which is probably why smart cars and autopilots are so difficult to implement properly.
It is, because, you know, how do you, it's hard to foresee everything that happens.
Yep.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. Until you get that experience and say, oh.
Right.
Yeah, until you go wrong with it.
Right.
You mentioned coding, and I'm glad you did, because it seems like, I mean, Eastern Europe is big on, like, starting coding from preschool. I mean, kindergarten, you're right. Learning coding. So I think a lot of the great apps that we're going to see in maybe the next 18 years or so are going to be all out of Eastern Europe. So I think that's very important, and even here at Raider, we've got like 3 or 4 coders sitting like on the other side of this wall right now working on projects. What other jobs in the tech industry do you see there being holes, especially in Lafayette, that need to really be filled that we don't have people yet?
Now, that's a great question, Jason. And I don't know if I have the answer to every one. You know, my phone rings and my email fills up a lot for job requests, for interns. But no doubt the whole data science side of things are important, because it goes across industry, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's dealing with just huge volumes of data now, mm-hmm. right? No matter whether it's in the healthcare industry, whether it's in manufacturing, whether it's in insurance, just about everybody has tons of data. Then when you start looking at all the device data now, right? The Internet of Things, IoT. Right? How do you manage all of that? How do you ensure security around that? How do you know that is valid data? And what do you do with all that? So that's been a big request of ours is you know, how do we apply data science? And interesting enough is that, it's a computer science curriculum. It's an informatics curriculum. It's a math curriculum. It's mm-hmm. a statistics curriculum. You know, it's not a very easily solved problem.
Interesting. And that brings up, that's makes a lot of sense, because, yeah, the amount of data we're generating right now, just talking over these microphones into this computer, is and we do this every week. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had to get stuff off of my computer because I filled up. There was so much data. But you don't want to lose that data, because you want to be able to access that. And even access that data can be tough sometimes. All right, so I want to know what's next. So I have, the Echo Auto in my car, and I can tell it to turn on my light before I get home, or open up the garage door, or unlock the front door. Play music, so when I walk in, my dogs know I'm coming now, because it's when everything turns on. Then we have the wearables that we're all seeing, smart cars and the auto drive. I mean, we have a few Teslas in the parking lot, and it's funny to see them driving around the parking lot without a person inside of them.
I don't want to see that. Not yet.
Oh, the auto park, and the auto call.
Yeah,
just comes
in.
It's pretty impressive. Is there anything on the horizon that you've seen that people like me haven't seen yet?
I'm not a futurist, mm-hmm. but I usually see things in two approaches, right? So there's the evolutionary side, mm-hmm. and that's a little bit easier to see, right? You've seen the progression. You mentioned wearables. You've seen the progression in self-driving vehicles and autonomous vehicles.
Yep.
We've seen the progression on the miniaturization of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that will continue. I think where the maturity is coming in that market becomes on the AI and machine learning side,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay.
So I think that's an evolutionary side. At some point, people are going to say, it'll be a WTF moment where they'll say, this is amazing, but it kind of built up. The other one is coming from the side of the revolutionary, where it just kind of comes out of left field, right? Where we weren't expecting that, right? And we've seen a lot of that over the years in this gig economy, mm-hmm. where who would have thought that Uber would be Uber, right?
Yeah.
Right. For example, I think the integration of a lot of the different technologies that we've mm-hmm. talked about is one of the things that will probably bridge between evolution and revolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it knows that we not only need to go see the doctor, but have already alerted the doctor or the emergency room that, there's something not right.
Right. Evolution and revolution.
Right. I think healthcare, while we've had a lot of missteps on electronic healthcare and healthcare records and on innovation around wearables, I think we're now at the point where it's what we are accepting, and it's what we will see. It's going to save us money. It's going to make us healthier. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to increase the criticality of care. So I see healthcare innovation as being very key on the evolution revolution side.
Breaking down those, you know, everybody can have access to health care at some point because the smart devices price is going down. And boy, it can save lives. Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, I think, and that's what, multi-billion-dollar industry, so they have the resources to put the R&D into it. But yeah, the fact that I can see how many, you know, I've already walked 6,000 steps today, and I'll probably put in 12,000 by the time it's done, and I can see my heart rate is at 62. In real time, that's amazing, you know, considering I still had a rotary phone when I was born, you know, and I was only born in 78. So, and now I can just, I can literally tell my Echo Dot to call my other Echo Dot at home, and we have a phone conversation without using phones. So how awesome is that?
Right.
Well, we could go on forever, and and maybe at some other time we will. I have some more technical questions that I'll ask you off air, like Lambda Rail, things like that, that other people don't really care about so much. But Matt, thank you for being here. Jan,
thank you so much as well.
Yeah, this is always fun.
Thanks to Raider for making our podcast possible. And of course, Iberia Bank and Lafayette General Health. They're so generous in their support of our show. And Matt Delcom, I really appreciate your story. You've got a great story to share. And thank you for opening up about your life and what you love about UL Lafayette. It's been good to have you.
Thanks, Janice. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. To our listeners, thank you again. You can visit our website, discoverlafayette.net, or even better, do both. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple or Google or anywhere you get your podcasts.
And on your Echo Dot.
On your Echo Dot, yeah, or Alexa. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift.